Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 114, Sinai and Synapses. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And our guest today is Jeffrey Middleman. He is the founding director of an organization called Sinai and Synapses, which bridges the religious and scientific worlds, offering people a worldview that is scientifically grounded and spiritually uplifting. Our interview with Jeff Middleman is part of our investigation of spiritual innovation, specifically the organizations that were part of the pilot cohort of Klal's Glean Incubator. Over the last few weeks, we've talked to some folks who are running synagogues and synagogue-adjacent organizations, but this week is a little different. Jeff is a rabbi with ordination from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion of Reform Judaism, and he was a congregational rabbi for 7 years. But his current organization is something different. In its words, Sinai and Synapses equips scientists, clergy, and dedicated laypeople with knowledge and skills to become role models, ambassadors, and activists for grappling with the biggest and most important questions we face. Sinai and Synapses believes that in order to enhance ourselves and our world, we need both religion and science as sources of wisdom, as the spark for new questions, and as inspiration and motivation. We're excited to jump into our conversation with Jeff Middleman, looking at the question of why it's so important to bridge the world of science and the world of Judaism. So, Jeff Middleman, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Lex. Glad to be here.
Well, so I think this is the first interview that we're doing with somebody who's focused on science and Judaism. So I think it's a really interesting new avenue for us to explore. And I was hoping that we could just start a little bit with understanding what Sinai and Synapses is all about.
Sinai and Synapses bridges the worlds of religion and science. And the way that we often say it is that we're looking for different questions that are scientifically grounded and spiritually uplifting. So looking at what are some of the biggest and most important and most interesting questions that are grounded in the best science that we know right now, and how can we use that as a way to elevate who we are as individuals, as a society, as the world as a whole? Another way that we sometimes phrase it is that the biggest questions that we deal with are not scientific and they're not religious, they're human. And so where can we find wisdom from both traditions to be able to enhance who we are?
Can you give us just like one example of that, just so that we can sort of understand how that applies in a particular real life case?
One of my favorite ones is about memory. What could be more Jewish than memory? Remember that we were slaves in the land of Egypt. Remember Shabbat. Remember yard sites. Remember the Holocaust. Memory, memory, memory. Remember, remember, remember. But there's a tremendous amount of research about the way memory works and the way memory doesn't work. There's a difference between what's called semantic memory and episodic memory. Semantic memory is something that's recalled. So remembering that 5 times 4, that's 20. But remembering what you had for dinner last night, that has a very different feel to it. That actually feels almost like a recording, a DVR of fast forwarding or rewind. And semantic memory is recalled, but episodic memory is reconstructed. We tend to be able to use the present to be able to fill in the gaps of the past. And the purpose of the past, the purpose of memory is not to think about the past. It's about to bring the past into the present or the future. Memory is really about how do we use the knowledge that we've gained from the years of our experience to be able to help us right here and now. So you don't think about when you need to charge your phone when you're at 78%. You realize, oh my God, I have to charge my phone when it's at 3% and I forgot to charge my phone and what am I going to do now? In the same way, we don't say, remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt because boy, wasn't that a horrible thing to have happened. You say, remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt so that we can be compassionate towards other people, to open up our hearts to the stranger. So when we're thinking about memory, it's not just what does Judaism have to say about memory and what's the science of memory, but how can we bring those two things together to enhance who we are?
So I'm thinking, as you're talking about Stephen Jay Gould's idea of noma, or non-overlapping magisteria, where he talks about religion and science being kind of two parallel things that really kind of ought not to meet one another, and they're both wonderful, but should be kept separate. I think that's at least how I've always understood him. But you're talking about something else. So could you help us understand what happens, what happens with an idea like that? You know, how is the idea that we're going to make religion more effective by understanding the science better and perhaps vice versa? Or is it some other type of goal? And it kind of, how do you see what's the objective of all this in terms of, you know, what would it look like if it were super successful?
Yeah, the non-overlapping magisteria is actually the one that my experience most Jews buy into. And it usually works pretty well on a day-to-day basis, on a day-to-day level. Most people, and probably most of the people listening here, are not thinking about science and religion on a day-to-day basis. They're paying their bills, they're taking their kids to school, they're buying milk, they're going about their lives. They're not really thinking about where science and religion bump up against each other. But we situate ourselves in an intellectual climate, in an intellectual milieu. So if we were to go into a time machine in the year 1400 and say, what was the center of the universe? The answer everyone would say is the Earth. And how would we know that? Well, because the church said so, or God said so, or the Torah said so. And as Copernicus and Galileo pushed that information, pushed that knowledge, how we understood ourselves changed radically. So there are areas in which what had been the realm of religion, science has encroached on that purview. So the non-overlapping magisteria works until it doesn't. And so what's often happened is that religion has then become, well, it's the source of ethics. Religion teaches us how to be a good person. I was taught that, I'm sure. Many people were taught that, except do you know somebody who's ethical and not religious? Do you know somebody who's religious and not ethical? So what religion has really become in 21st century America is a question of meaning. And science can actually help us grapple with and develop a sense of meaning. How do we understand ourselves? That's not something that's given from the top down. That's something that we build from our own relationships, our own knowledge. So for us, what is really successful for us is, are people able to integrate scientific knowledge in a way that gives them more meaning and helps them act better in this world?
What does it look like when sort of programmatically Sinai and Synapses is doing the work of blending or blurring or Venn diagramming science and religion?
So we have two main projects that we do. Aside from Scholar in Residence, I travel all around and do teaching and Scholar in Residence gigs all around the country. But our two big projects, one is called Scientists and Synagogues, which is using the top-notch scientists, particle physicists, and technologists, and geneticists, and paleontologists who are members of congregations. They're embedded in their community, and giving them an opportunity to share how they integrate their scientific work with their Jewish life. So we've had a couple of amazing examples. One was a synagogue in Chicago that looked at Jewish and scientific views on time. And they had a particle physicist and a paleontologist and a historian of science in conversation with the rabbi. They did a 3-week adult education class to explore how do we experience time. Judaism is very rooted on time and the holidays and questions of the origins of the universe, and how does Kabbalah explore different questions of that. But what's the difference between time that is 13.7 billion years old versus 500 million years old versus the way we experience Jewish life in 3,000 years? And what does that look like? And so these scientists, who are all members of the congregation, they had never really been in conversation with each other before that, started to explore Jewish and scientific views on time. Another amazing example, one synagogue outside of Boston has tremendous technology. It's rooted where it's in the Route 128 corridor. So they have all these people who are focused on technology. They brought in the vice president of Google to explore questions of the way technology is changing our interactions. And the rabbi was hoping they get, you know, their best programs, they would get 20, 25 people. They were hoping maybe they'd get 50. They had over 100 people coming to hear this VP of Google, who talked about a variety of different topics, but one that he explored was the parallel between self-driving cars and a text from biblical and then rabbinic literature of an ox that gores. So if you have an ox that has its own mind and it's going to gore somebody, it's going to harm somebody, who's responsible for that? And there's a really clear analogy of a self-driving car, because is it the programmer who is in charge? Is it the person who buys the car? What's going to be the trade-off of what the self-driving car or the ox is able to do? And what's that relationship? Well, who has that responsibility? And so that was an incredibly rich conversation. The other project is our interfaith fellowship, our Sinai and Synapses fellowship. And that is Jews, Christians, Muslims, atheists. We've had a Baha'i, and it's a competitive process. And we fly people out 3 times a year for 2 years, and they come together for learning and cross-pollination on specific topics and subjects, ranging from what's the cost of being right and the benefit of being wrong in both science and religion, or what happens when religion helps us heal and how does science help us heal, and what's the difference between healing and curing, medically, scientifically, spiritually. And so we bring together doctoral students and professors and pastors and rabbis and journalists, and they come together, and it creates this wonderful cross-pollination from people from Kansas to San Francisco to Boston to DC. And these are people who have never met each other in advance and never thought about these kinds of conversations, but they're all people who are passionate about bridging the worlds of religion and science.
What's so refreshing for me when I hear about the topics you're exploring and the questions you're asking and the gatherings you're convening is that, so I've seen, I'm putting in quotes, I've seen the science and religion conversations, even in some Jewish spaces, but I've seen them from a place that for me is unhealthy. I've seen often Orthodox organizations who hold an event and they bring somebody and the goal is to say, like, we can find a way for X miracle, whether it's the parting of the sea or the creation of the world 6,000 years, like we can find a way for that to jive with some scientific finding that somebody has. And it comes off as this disingenuous, like, hey, kids, we're trying, like we get that science isn't the enemy and we're going to try and build it into what we believe, but like, we're not really going to do so in a way that allows us to question our basic assumptions about it. Like we're just going to do it to prove our existing mindset about theology, et cetera, et cetera. And what you're doing, if I understand it correctly, is you're not looking to prove any particular one thing, like you're not either religiously or scientifically, you're not trying to say, like, look at how science is correct about this and religion isn't, or vice versa. You're saying here's a topic, go, let's see what arises. I'd love to hear, like, if you have thoughts about sort of those ways that perhaps these programs aren't done as effectively in some places, and why what you're doing healthily takes on that in a different way.
We talk a lot about different models that we talk about science and religion. And the lowest model is what we call the conflict model, which is science and religion are totally at odds. And it's just not a productive conversation. It's also not, actually many fewer people buy into that model than we might think. What you're talking about is the next model up, at least in terms of my mind of sophistication, which is the concert model, which is really trying to hold two things to be true that aren't always true together, which is science and religion both explain the same kinds of questions. The problem is that the best definition I've heard about science is that science's goal is to help us become progressively less wrong. Science never proves, science disproves. science helps us understand the world a little bit better. So, for example, Newton's laws, they're not wrong. They still work in this kind of way, but Einstein's theories helped us become less wrong. Science helps us understand, here's where the flaws of our thinking had been. So trying to be able to say, let's prove that the Red Sea actually happened. Well, what if the archaeology undoes that? And if you're basing your faith, if you're basing your religion on science, the science can change. The science can be actually very shaky. And what we've discovered is that if people buy into the concert model, as soon as they say, wait a second, there's a flaw in my logic here, it actually collapses into the conflict model. Particularly in 12 and 13-year-olds, as they're learning more and more about science, what they were taught about the Torah was that it's literally true. They then say, wait a second, how can I reconcile this? And if there's not an understanding that, well, the Bible is not a science textbook, let's not read it in that kind of way, what tends to happen is it will collapse into the conflict model. And at least in the Jewish world, they will then reject religion. They will reject religion because they will say, oh my God, I've been lied to my whole life. The whole thing is a sham. Why even bother? In the fundamentalist Christian world, that tends to happen, but there's a rejection then of science. That's one of the real problems of the concert model. It is philosophically very difficult and personally very difficult because you're trying to hold on to something until it actually collapses. The next model up is, Dan, what you were talking about of the contrast model of non-overlapping magisteria. And that works for most of the time because most people are not thinking about these questions in a day-to-day basis. But the model that we talk about through Sinai and Synapses is the contact model. What are the human questions that we're grappling with? What is a topic where we're looking for more knowledge, more inspiration, more guidance on some sort of topic? Because science is not a disembodied collection of facts. Science is a process, and it's done by human beings. And human beings are fallible, but human beings also have a sense of inspiration. If you were to ask a biologist, why are you studying flatworms? They're not going to say, I don't know. It's just like my doctoral professor, my dissertation professor told me to do that. They're going to say, no, you know, I'm so fascinated by the neural network that happens in the flatworm. And how does that help us understand the human brain? And it's so exciting. And, you know, you talk to any scientist, almost certainly, hopefully, they're going to be really excited about their work because they're trying to understand the world. They're trying to understand the universe. Judaism is also, and religion is a way to help us understand, who am I? How do I situate myself in this world?
One time I was invited to an event where a supposed science professor, I can't say for sure, you know, what his scientific bona fides were, but he made this presentation about how the beginning of the book of Genesis didn't conflict at all with scientific discoveries of the Big Bang. And there was this whole thing about how it starts where their world is, you know, chaos and waste or void and whatever, you know, and that sort of tracks to the idea that there was chaos before the Big Bang and then let there be light. You know, there was this Big Bang and then sort of everything went from there. And he kind of carefully made connections between each one. And I raised my hand and I said, well, but you left out a part, because between the chaos and the let there be light, there's this other thing where the Spirit of God is floating over the water. And he says, oh, well, that's just kind of a poetic word, you know. But I was like, no, you can't do that, because there's actually water. The word water is used. And your whole point was that every scientific sort of idea in the beginning of the Torah, like, you can show what the real science was. So, yeah, the Spirit of the Lord, like, that might be poetic, but that it was floating over the water, like, you actually have to account for that. What was this water? You know, and what was remarkable to me was that, you know, I guess he hadn't thought of it, and he didn't come up with some, you know, well, you know, maybe there was hydrogen or whatever. You could probably come up with something. But instead, you know, he just kind of tried to kind of evade that part of the question. And, you know, I guess to me, like, this is where I guess, like, there's two elements, two ways of looking at what religion is that I think sort of come up here. Because this particular man, I think he was very, very fundamentalist, let's say, and he truly saw religion as fundamentally not being a human process, like you talked about science, but being something that God has imposed on us and something that God has created. And so the interaction between science and religion, to some extent, at least, you could argue, I guess, that there's a certain way of thinking about science is also that, but that in his mind, there was some kind of idea that, you know, there's a scientific human process that we haven't figured out everything, and religion is all figured out. And so at one day when we figure out all the science, we'll see that there's no conflict whatsoever. So that's one sort of way of looking at it. But the other is kind of, if you understand also that religion is a human process of trying to figure out how to live and what the world is all about, you can almost imagine religion is the kind of literary or poetic side, and the science is the kind of experimental. And I guess I can see very easily how, if we understand the two to both be human processes, how there can truly be a wonderful give and take between them. I guess the question is, how does that work with people who really in some deep fundamental way believe that religion is really from God?
Yeah. So in many ways, that's actually not our target audience. My rule of thumb is the conversation going to be productive? Am I trying to convince you, or are you trying to convince me? That's not going to be helpful, I think, in a lot of ways. Now, there's a difference between religion and God. In my mind, religion is an attempt to help us understand God, understand the divine. I'm a big believer in Brad Artson's work of process theology. How do I experience God? How do I experience the divine? What's the language I use about God? And so there's a difference, again, this is a little bit of mathematics, of there's a difference between infinity and really, 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 really big, right? And so if there is an infinite God, even if we can understand something really, 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 really big, we're still never going to understand the infinite in that kind of way. And you talk about something that's really, really important, which is the poetry, particularly of the first words of Genesis, but in a lot of different ways, poetry expresses truth. Poetry doesn't express facts. And using those in different methodologies is a real problem there. And there's nobody who says, do science and poetry conflict? But you can use a lot of poetic language to talk about science. Absolutely. But what you're going to talk about, you're going to flip different hats to be able to talk about this. So I get asked the question of a lot of ways of how do you talk about the integration of the Big Bang cosmology and the opening verses of Genesis. And the answer that I give is that, first of all, Genesis is not meant to be a science textbook. So Genesis is not meant to be a science textbook. Genesis is an expression of how do we understand the origins of the universe. And that was an attempt to be able to describe that. But one of the wonderful lines in Genesis is that, particularly in Genesis 1, every word, every day ends with vayera vayivoker, vayera vayivoker. And the word erev connotes a sense of chaos, erev rav, a mixed multitude. And the word boker actually connotes a sense of order. So the word levaker literally means to distinguish something. So in the stories of Genesis, the beginning of Genesis, each day ends with a movement from chaos to order. Now, I don't know about your kitchen. I don't know about your house. I don't normally go from chaos to order. My house always, with two little kids, goes from order to chaos. The universe's natural state is to move towards chaos. But we don't live in a world totally of chaos. How do we overcome that? We have to invest a level of energy to be able to overcome that chaos. The only way to overcome the universe's natural state of chaos is for us to be able to invest a little bit of order. And so the opening verses of Genesis are a reminder that the only way we can build a world that has a little bit more order, a little bit more peace, a little bit more justice, is if we are the ones who invest ourselves in that. Is that literally true? No. But to me, it's a way to understand those first verses that are respectful of what the text says, but it allows me to then read it in a way that gives me meaning, that is also grounded in what the best science says right now.
So I feel as if there's almost like an elephant in the room question that we haven't asked yet, but that I'm sure you hear all the time, which is like, why are there so many Jewish scientists? Like, we know that this is sort of an empirical reality that a lot of Jews out there are in scientific fields and have historically been. And like, what's going on there? I mean, you've given us already some great thoughts on overlaps of science and religion and what we can learn, but why is it that there seem to be so many Jews interested in this?
One line that we say through Sinai and Synapses is, in a lot of ways, the challenge in the Jewish world is not getting Jews excited about science, it's about getting Jews excited about Judaism. And there's a big philosophical, intellectual history and trajectory as to why Jews even today love science. There is a large part in Judaism that is, particularly in rabbinic literature, of questioning. One of the most common questions that they ask in rabbinic literature is, Minayin, how do you know this? And the wonderful example is the story of the Evan of Achnai, which is when two rabbis are debating about a piece of minute Jewish law, and they're arguing back and forth, and one rabbi says, if I'm right, let the stream flow backwards, and the stream flows backwards, and the first rabbi says, that's not proof. And then the tree plants, and the second rabbi says, that's not proof. And eventually they say, if I'm right, let God himself say that I'm right. And God comes down and says, why are you arguing? Rabbi Eliezer is right. At this point, Rabbi Joshua says, essentially, God, quiet, you're not part of this conversation anymore. Once the Torah was given, it's on us. The rest of the story is a very challenging, problematic piece, but it's a real emphasis in Judaism of, we don't take knowledge purely on faith. Judaism has constantly asked, how do you know something? And I think in large part also because the Bible is not taken literally. There's interpretations, and this person said this, and they'll expand on that knowledge in this kind of way. In the same way that science, there's a paper that'll get published in Science magazine, and a couple years later, they'll say, wait a second, there was a mistake in that methodology, let me expand on that. And there are questions of, well, is science, are all these studies getting reproduced? And there's problems with reproducibility. And in fact, that failure is science's greatest strength, because it's saying, wait a second, we've even made a mistake about how we're going to correct the mistakes. Let's correct these corrections. And Judaism does that with the Bible, and then rabbinic literature, with Mishnah, and then Gemara, and then Rashi, and then codes, and then later literature, and then modern commentators. There's always a building on, we're not going to reject what's been said before, but if there was something that needs to get changed, we can do that. In the same way that we don't reject Newton's laws, but we build on that to be able to use Einstein.
So I wonder if we could return to the example that you brought up at the beginning of our conversation, or perhaps other examples, but you brought up the example of memory at the beginning, where you talked about Judaism has a lot to say about memory, and there have been a lot of scientific studies and discoveries of late about memory. So as you reflect on that as an example, I mean, I guess in my mind, it's thinking like, what does Judaism have to learn, and how does Judaism get better in terms of understanding the function of memory from recent scientific discoveries? Or perhaps how does Judaism's approach to memory inspire scientific searches? How do you kind of think about that?
I mean, look, so there's a guy named Eric Kandel who won a Nobel Prize, who spoke at a congregation in White Plains about the memory piece of this. I'm actually going to give another example besides the memory one. There is a professor at Northeastern University that I become friends with, a guy named David DeSteno, who has done tremendous work about compassion and the science of compassion. And the world stands on three things, on Torah, on prayer, and on gemilut chasadim, acts of loving kindness. So how can we better understand compassion and the role of compassion, and how can we be more compassionate people? So that's a wonderful way in which he has actually studied religious traditions about compassion, Buddhist and Jewish and Christian ways of compassion, but he's also done a lot of work about how do we engender more compassion in this world. And he has a new book out called Emotional Success, and actually how compassion can help us achieve our goals better. But one great example that he gives is, how do we build compassion in other people? And it's actually really, really, really simple. You don't have to be spending a lot of time and energy and effort. You find a point of similarity or connection to somebody else. And the example that the classic example about compassion and how do you gauge compassion? How do you measure it? Usually they do this as a way of there's a plant who is carrying a whole bunch of boxes of pens, and the person that they're testing, they knock into the plant, and they look to see how many pens does the person bring up, how much time do they spend helping somebody else. That's how they gauge that measure. So what DeStenno has been able to find is, one example they did was told people, you're coming into an experiment to talk about line perception, visual perception, and I want you to gauge a bunch of lines. And that was the example. And then at the end of the study, they said, wow, you gauged all those lines at 48% more. You are clearly an overestimator. And some people said, boy, you were about 35% too low. You're an underestimator. Zero cultural baggage, zero history, zero religious background, totally manufactured. What they discovered was that the people who were overestimators were more compassionate to people that they saw as fellow overestimators. And if they were underestimators, they were more compassionate to people who were underestimators. And they were slightly less compassionate if they were on the flip side. So we have all sorts of different identities that we have. So I'm Jewish. I live in New York. I'm a Yankee fan. I like crosswords. However I can connect to somebody, I can find a point of connection. So if I ever do a scholar in residence in Boston, I am not going to start by saying, and I got to tell you, Aaron Boone's home run in 2003 when the Yankees beat the Red Sox made me so happy, right? No one's going to listen to me for the rest of my talk. But if I start by saying, you know what? I spent a year in Boston and I spent so much time in Coolidge Corner, and I've got friends who are working at BU. And if that's how I start, there's going to be a much, much more of a sense of connection and compassion. So as we're talking about Jewish texts on compassion, if you're looking to do a mitzvah day, how can you get more people doing kinds of work on doing a mitzvah day, on a coat drive or soup kitchen? Find a point of connection. Oh, this is a person who lives in my town. This is a person who, and you may have to manufacture it, but you know what? It's okay if it's manufactured. You're still going to be able to find this point of connection and compassion here.
And when I hear you talking about that, I kind of am picturing the kind of highly affiliated Jew who's listening to this and who's trying to listen for this scientific discovery and to say, oh, and Judaism is so great at that. I mean, we have the best ways of helping people become more compassionate or helping people become more identified with others, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that I'm so interested in the possibility that we hear something like that and we say, you know, Judaism's not so good at that. Right. Whether it's this particular thing or just some other element, you know, and it's like, how can we make Judaism better at helping people become more compassionate or whatever the scientific thing that we're trying to discover? And I think that there are a lot of people that say, but if we started to pick up all these new approaches from science, from positive psychology, it wouldn't be Judaism anymore because we were taking all this stuff from these other realms. And so I guess I'm interested in thinking about, and maybe you do this thought and you discuss with others, like, how do we look at Judaism as a process like we are comfortable seeing science as a process? Like, we're comfortable with the idea that if science discovers something new and integrates it into science, like, great, that's what science is all about. If we do that in Judaism, there's some sense of, that's kind of too bad that we didn't have that for the last 2,000 years.
The example that I like, the analogy that I particularly like of moving beyond this triumphalism is Judaism and religion as a whole as a particular language. And this analogy for me works very well because language doesn't exist just to be able to have language. That's not its goal. We evolved language to be able to communicate and communicate more articulately, but we don't speak language. I speak English, or some people speak Hebrew or French or Urdu or whatever the different languages, and they may actually be mutually unintelligible. You could potentially translate, but there's mistranslations that can happen. But everyone who is speaking a language is doing that to be able to communicate. religion too, the purpose of religion, the job religion gets done is not to help us become more religious. The purpose of religion is to be able, in my mind, to facilitate a connection with something larger than ourselves, to facilitate connections and a stronger sense of community, to be able to give us a sense of meaning and hope in this world. There are a lot of different ways in which religion does that. And that's the job that religion gets done. How Judaism does that is going to be different than the way Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism is going to do that. And there are going to be parallels. There are going to be translations. And you might need to have multiple translators doing different pieces there. But being able to say, I speak the language of Judaism because that's the language that I grew up in and I feel most comfortable with, and I know it, and it works very well for me. And I want to be able to understand how can I speak other languages, but not to be able to say my language is better than your language, because we're all ultimately trying to communicate. Religion, we're all trying to be able to build a stronger sense of self and a stronger world. And so how do we come together in different ways to be able to do that?
I want to make sure that as we investigate and experiment and you know, dig deep in all the other scientific verbs I can think of into all of these issues, that we also take a second and ask, so like, why are you doing this of all of the things you could do in the world? Not because I'm not asking that dismissively. I'm very stimulated right now, but why Jeff Middleman? How, Jeff Middleman, have you found your way into this particular niche of the world, which I think so many people are interested in as a side project, but none or very few have gone and taken the leap to making it sort of the center of their professional life. So how did you come to lead Sinai and Synapses and care about all of these bridged issues?
I'll start on the more abstract level. So I've always loved science and I always loved Judaism growing up. My father was the president of my synagogue growing up. My mom was on the board. So I was always in the synagogue there all the time. And I always loved science and math. I was very, very into puzzles and experiments and just being able to figure out the world and the universe. And as I went to college, I started college as a math major, and I knew with absolute 100% certainty I was going to be a math major. I lasted 4 semesters and then switched to religion and Jewish studies.
I only lasted 2, and then I was Judaic studies.
That's right, and that's not uncommon, by the way. Because one thing that I realized as I was doing a lot of the math world is that we face a lot of questions, and there's two different ways to be able to deal with questions. One is to come up with an answer, and one is to come up with a response. So math tended to have answers of if you work hard enough, you can solve it and you'll figure out the right answer. Whereas other realms, like Judaism, it's a response. It's more creative. There are more opportunities there. And so I shifted in that world to be able to say, I didn't want to move away from what's the answer to be, but I wanted to be able to say, what are the responses? So I switched to religion and Jewish studies. And when I was in rabbinical school, I did my rabbinic thesis. I looped back, moved away from what they would call the hard sciences of math and physics to the more psychological sciences, cognitive science, which became very hot in the mid-2000s, which was when I was in rabbinical school, and wrote my rabbinic thesis on rabbinic literature and emotional intelligence, reading about questions of self-control and memory and happiness and all of these different topics that we were talking about, and seeing where does the science come in and where does the Judaism come in. And so I joked that for my rabbinic thesis, I spent some of the time in the Clow Library in Cincinnati and some time at Barnes & Noble. And it was amazing. I loved it, being able to read these different pieces. And so I was ordained in 2007, and I started as an assistant and then associate rabbi in Chappaqua. I knew going in that I wanted to be an assistant or associate rabbi, and they said, our expectation is that you're going to be leaving in 5 years. And I said, great, I want to be here. I want to learn what it's like to be a congregational rabbi in the trenches. I also don't think that being a senior rabbi of a congregation is what I want to do with my life, but I'm really happy here. I ended up there through 2014. My last year was 2013. And because I knew my contract was going to be up, I said, what do I want to do with my life now? And I started to think about 2011, and I was bringing in science. It almost became a running joke in every time I was preaching or teaching, saying there's a fascinating study that shows X or Y or Z, whether it was the Torah portion or an adult ed. And I said, you know what? There's a niche here to get filled. There's a lot that's happening in the Christianity and science world, but there's nothing in the Judaism and science world. I was worried I was going to be the only one interested in doing this work. And we're finding that there are more and more people who are saying, I need this. I'm looking for this. I want to be able to find the best science and a way to be able to enhance who I am.
One piece that Dan and I are constantly talking about in terms of what the goals of our podcast are and like why we do any of this ourselves is we have a desire for people out there of all stripes to be experimenting with Judaism. And we use the word experiment intentionally because to us, it really is a process similar to being in a lab. And we use words like lab with sort of the stuff of Judaism. And I don't know if the best analogies would be chemistry and like mixing different parts together and seeing what happens, or if the best ideas would be physics and like I don't know, but we're talking about encouraging people and creating contexts for people to experiment with what new forms of Judaism could be. And as you think about Judaism and sort of what the future of Judaism could look like, you're doing a wonderful part of that with your work at Sinai and Synapses. What would it look like from your knowledge of science to really experiment with the future of Judaism? Like what does that mean? Because I think you could help us understand what we mean, even though we use the phrase so much.
The word that I'm going to say is fail. Experimentations are designed in many ways to fail. And one of my favorite authors is a guy named Stuart Feierstein, who is at the Columbia University. He's presented for us a few times for Sinai and Synapses. He's written two books that are excellent. One is called Ignorance, How It Drives Science, and Failure, Why Science is So Successful. There is a real view in American society that only success is good. And if you fail, that's a big problem. And Feierstein says that failure in and of itself has value. Because if you fail, it means you're trying something without knowing in advance how it's going to work. And one piece is that's helpful with failure is you want to start small. You want to make sure that the cost of the failure is as minimal as possible. And because then you can build on that. And then you can say, you know what? I didn't invest 5 years of my life on this and not knowing if it was going to work. Trying to be able to say, I want to try something. And I'm going to try this, 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 and I'm going to try that. And then to be able to say, is this replicable? Is this going to work in some kind of way? If not, why not? To be able to say, what are the questions that I need to be able to ask? Why am I doing what I'm doing? What is going to happen if and when this doesn't work? If it does work, why was it successful? And if it didn't, what tweaks do I need to be able to work on? Ultimately, lots of great ideas are going to come and they should be tried and recognize that a vast majority of them are not going to thrive, but being willing to accept that and being willing to be able to say what's going to work ultimately is going to have a real impact on the Jewish community. And how can we build from there?
So as we close out, what's a teaching or a thought or an idea that you'd love to leave our listeners with just about why this work of bridging science and religion, like what should we be leaving with as we, you know, go on to whatever's next in our life, making dinner, taking a shower? I don't know what the heck is next, but what should we be thinking about?
The most important, in my mind, the three most important human elements that we need to be grappling with is how can we be kind to other people? How can we be curious about each other and the world as a whole? And how can we always find a sense of awe and gratitude towards both the universe as a whole, the world, the individual. If we have an orientation of, first of all, most importantly, I want to be kind to other people, because there's a lot of argument back and forth and demonization back and forth in our society right now. And I think being able to say, I want to talk to and treat people with a level of kindness wherever they are coming, philosophically or religiously, that's the most important piece. But as we're looking at who we are and how we understand ourselves and how we understand the world, to recognize how much we don't know, and that curiosity in and of itself is a tremendous virtue, and being able to have a level of radical amazement, in the words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, and my tagline of my email is, just to live is a blessing, just to be is holy. Religion can give us some language for that, and science also helps us experience that in a new kind of way.
Jeff, if there are listeners who are really fascinated by what you're talking about, and they're scientists, and they're out there saying, wait, I thought I was the only one, what should they do? How can they contact you? How can they get involved?
So on our website, sinaiandsynapses.org, about once a week, we send out some fantastic content from our fellows, from scientists and synagogues, and great articles that we're reading. So you can sign up on our website. You can follow us on facebook.com/sinaiandsynapses, or can friend me, and I'm also on Twitter at Rabbi Mittleman, and Sinai and Synapses is at Sinai Synapses.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff Mittleman, for joining us. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun for me too.
Thanks again to all of you out there listening. We want to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can hit up Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Next, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. Or you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a one-time basis or monthly recurring basis. And you can do either one of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.